Hi, I'm Susie Larson. Thanks so much for listening to this podcast from Live the Promise. There are many more podcasts available up on the website at myfaithradio.com, and your support makes this possible. Thank you.
For tuning in today. So glad you joined us. I'm Bill Arnold in for Susie Larson, and this is Live the Promise. We're here to help you engage in a strong and active walk of faith. So welcome to Live the Promise, and a very happy Thursday to you. You know, I was driving over here today, and I just heard on the news that it looks like Mike Pence is going to be Donald Trump's vice presidential pick. And, you know, Mike Pence was once a good radio host. So I'm thinking maybe one day I could be a good radio host as well. Anyway, today's subject is going to be a very adult themed. So we're going to give you the warning right now up front that you might want to get the younger ears away from the radio, or you might want to listen to this later via podcast. We're talking about today to Michael Cusick. He's written a book called Surfing for God. And his topic today is the porn problem that goes on across the world. It's even become a public health issue in this election, but it is more than a small problem. It is an enormous problem. And my co-host on Real Recovery, George Fraser, once said, "The only men that don't struggle with porn are the ones who have never seen it." And it certainly is an issue that is invading families, marriages. And it's a big problem. And I think Michael Cusick is one of the best voices on this subject. And your book is just sensational. And I've read it and passed it on to many people. And your story is compelling. And not only that, but you're really a nice guy. Michael, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks, Bill. It's good to be here with you.
Thank you. And I've also asked Dr. Glenn Pickering, who was in my first hour. I said, if you don't have to go anywhere too quickly, why don't you stick around? Glenn's done lots of work counseling people with sexual addictions. So, Glenn, welcome back to hour two of Live the Promise.
Good to be included.
Thank you. Michael, your story is so amazing because you were married at a fairly young age. Were you in your 20s?
I was 26 years old.
26,
yeah, that's
right. Pretty young. And you had an issue right away in your marriage. Will you share with our listeners a little of your journey?
Yeah, it actually starts long before my marriage at age 26. I was 4 years old, and I was sexually abused and exposed to pornography. And that continued through my childhood in an Irish Catholic alcoholic home. I came to Christ through the ministry of Young Life when I was 16 and had a very dramatic awakening to knowing that God loved me. And yet, when I was 16 at that time, the addiction that I had to porn went underground because I thought that's not part of the life of a good Christian. So I worked really hard to get the outside of my life looking good, and the inside was still filled with brokenness and trauma and shame and anxiety. And I got married, and my wife knew that I, quote-unquote, struggled with lust and had addiction in my background, but she thought it was really something in the past. And 3 years in, my double life was exposed. And thanks be to God that today we're married. We just celebrated our 25th year of marriage and a strong, brand new marriage. But we walked quite a difficult path of healing, and I've continued to walk a journey of recovery and becoming whole in Christ.
Well, I've talked to your wife, Julianne, before, and she is such an amazing woman because this whole thing blew up in year three of your marriage. Am I right?
That's correct.
So that's pretty early on to have this problem surface and then to have her world kind of collapse on her, didn't it?
Exactly. Yeah, she uses the phrase that she learned during that season that she could be devastated but not destroyed because it really shook her to the very core of her foundations about what she believed about God and what she believed about her security and what she believed about intimacy and what it meant to trust. So it was something that in very different ways rocked us both and transformed us and created an opportunity for healing and change. But that's ultimately what led to us together ministering to couples and individuals through Restoring the Soul is what God took us through and how he brought hope out of the mess.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're just 3 years into your marriage. You're practically still newlyweds. There's no kids, causing lots of pressure in the relationship, and then you're still out with your double life. I would imagine she almost wanted a do-over, didn't she, at that stage of the marriage?
Yeah. She cried out to God and said, you know, this is not what I signed up for. And she felt like she would have left because she had biblical grounds with adultery and infidelity to leave, but she felt like the Lord didn't release her, and I'm grateful for that today. But that also forced her to have to enter into a process of looking at her heart and her life, not that in any way she was to blame for my behavior, because that's often something that men will say to their spouses, you know, if you look different or if we did X, Y, or Z different in the bedroom, then I wouldn't do this. So she was in no way responsible for my sin and behavior, but the pain and the betrayal really forced her to look at that and really go to a deep place with God and in counseling and in community.
So you've had how many years of, do we call it sobriety?
We just celebrated 22 years on July 10th, so this Sunday. I was actually speaking at a church in right outside of New York City on Saturday and didn't realize that the very next day, July 10th, was the 22-year anniversary of what I call the best and worst day of my life.
Mm-hmm. And that's the day you told your wife that, or you got exposed. Did you get caught in something?
Yeah, I wasn't as honorable as telling her. I got caught, and then she had to pry it out of me, and over the next several days, the truth came out from a little bit of bad to a whole lot of bad. And the reason why it was the worst day of my life is because I was actually or felt like I was literally being cut open. But the hardest part was watching her be so betrayed and traumatized. And it was the best day of my life because it's the first time in my life as a follower of Jesus. I've been a Christian at 14 years. But I make the distinction that though I've been a follower of Christ for 14 years, I never knew the love of God for 14 years. I never really believed that I was loved despite my worst stuff and for who I was. And she stood beside me with all the ups and downs of the emotions and really personified Christ to me in terms of offering a kind of love that was very redemptive and filled with grace.
Mm. So what direction... Talk a little bit about the way the whole porn industry is changing the landscape of young men in this world and how they're growing up into having such distorted views of marriage and sex and everything else because of what porn is doing.
Well, it really is changing not just the landscape, which is to say kind of the world in which boys and men grow up, but it's changing the actual internal reality. So depending on what study you look at, the average age of exposure of a child to pornography is either 9 or 11 years old. So we can take the average and say it's 10. And if a 10-year-old is exposed to pornography, and by the way, that's not just a naked picture of a woman, it's usually some kind of hardcore pornography, 86% of which is degrading or deprecatory toward women that involves some kind of violent context to it, and that's what kids are being exposed to. And so when they're exposed to that, boy or girl, and it is almost as much of an issue for girls as it is for boys, it begins to shape how we view intimacy, how we view relationships, and ultimately how we view sexuality, that sex becomes simply an act that's more and more removed from an intimate relationship, that it's something biological, that is an absolute need which trumps all other needs, and really that women are objects. Pornography, no matter how you slice it, pornography objectifies women in both the production of pornography and how it's consumed.
Mm-hmm. So kids are starting, obviously, at a much younger age just simply because they have a smartphone in their back pocket or access to a tablet or a computer, and they're seeing things that are coming into their minds that are horrifying.
Yeah, and we may think that Christian kids don't do this, but I know a lot of young men and preteens that call their smartphone their porn machine. Because that's what they do with it. They look at images, or they're using apps that, although they may not be pornographic, they can access inappropriate images from other people, things like Snapchat. And absolutely, it's gone from I need to drive across town and take the risk of getting out of my car and being seen at an adult bookstore, which is what my story was, because my sexual addiction and porn addiction was before the growth of the internet, to now it's in my pocket, and I can see an unlimited amount of sexual images that, again, don't start out at a very benign level, but actually start out at a very violent level that's degrading to women.
We are talking to Michael Cusick. He's written a book called Surfing for God, Discovering the Divine Desire Beneath Sexual Struggle. And there are 68 million searches, I think, a day for porn. And I know you've just about horrified every parent that's listening to the show today because of the accessibility of pornographic images that they can get on their smartphone or their tablet or computer. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to take a break. If you have a question for Michael, you can certainly give us a call, 1-877-933-2484. Again, this is a difficult subject, and remember to shield the ears of the young ones. You're listening to Live with the Promise. Bill Arnold in for Susie. We'll be right back. Friends, welcome back to Live the Promise. Bill Arnold in for Susie. I'm talking to Michael Cusick today. He's written a book called Surfing for God. He's an ordained minister, spiritual director, and licensed professional counselor who has experienced firsthand the restoring touch of God in a deeply broken life and marriage. Michael founded Restoring the Soul, a ministry whose mission is to provide life-changing care to Christian leaders. Michael's passion through 25 years of ministry is to connect life's broken realities with the healing power of the gospel. And Michael, I'm a big fan. I've devoured your book and recommended it to many people. And in my first hour, I had Dr. Glenn Pickering with us talking about relationships, and I begged him to stick around. And Glenn, you got a question.
I did, in fact. Michael, here's the, I keep wondering about this. When I work with couples who are dealing with, you know, whatever problem, because I've done it as long as I have, just like you've done your stuff for a long time, I can pretty much guarantee that they're going to hit X, Y, or Z obstacle. So I try and warn them ahead of time and tell them what to do about it before it happens. I call it inoculation. And I'm thinking, okay, so I'm thinking you know that too about people who are coming out of sexual addiction. So if you were going to advise one of the people who are listening maybe who are just maybe coming out of a sexual addiction or just really trying to make that commitment, what's an obstacle you can pretty much promise them they will hit, and what would you tell them to do about it?
That's a terrific question. One of the obstacles that they're going to hit individually is that they will hit a time where they're triggered and very much wanting to act out sexually.
Right.
So a lot of times men, after they disclose and they come clean, whether they're caught or they volunteer that, and about 95% of the time men are caught, they feel this wave of grace, and they feel this release, like, okay, I'm known, I'm loved, I'm accepted, this isn't good, but hey, I think I can do this. And I call that in my own life the wave of grace, that for about 2 years it literally carried me, and I had no temptation, no struggle. And that wave, just like a tsunami or just like a wave at a small pond, it's eventually going to settle and crash upon the shore, and we need to be prepared for that.
Right.
So then in the relationship, one thing that's inevitably going to happen is that trust issues will come up, that the betrayed spouse is going to say, well, you came home from work 15 minutes late,
or
you didn't answer your text, and what were you doing?
Right.
And that doesn't necessarily mean that it's a backslide or regressing, as you well know, but it's rather an opportunity to press into that and
right.
to learn to hear one another's hearts and focus on real intimacy, because porn addiction and sex addiction is false intimacy.
Right.
Michael, I wrote that question and handed it to Glenn to read. So
it was a brilliant question.
Thank
That's
you.
What I love
Thank
about
you.
Your show. We
Thank
gotta
you.
Keep it a little bit light in the midst of that.
I talk a little bit about the ways in which porn can rewire a person's brain.
Yeah, I'm so glad you're bringing that up, because from a Christian perspective, we see Jesus as the answer, but we sometimes don't know what the question is that we're actually asking, that he's the answer to. And the question is, why in the world does this seem so powerful to me when I have Christ inside of me and when I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me? And so I find it's awfully important to talk with folks about the power that porn has on the brain and how it rewires the brain. And number one, internet pornography is very, very different from what I saw as a kid and as a younger man with magazines and even video images.
Mm-hmm.
Because on the internet, the novelty, and God created our brains for novelty, to be stimulated by new visual things, the novelty is almost infinite and there's no end to it. And a person surfing the internet for porn can see hundreds or thousands of images in the context of an hour, and certainly many, many images in the context of many minutes. And what that does is that those images make the brain secrete dopamine, which is known as the gimme, gimme, gimme molecule, or the I gotta have it molecule. And that is the neurotransmitter in the brain that's responsible for all desire and wanting. So if your listeners right now were to think about their favorite food, whether that's a juicy steak on the grill or a BLT or a candy bar or an ice cream cone, if they were to focus on that in their mind's eye, dopamine would begin to be released in the brain. And pornography releases that in very high amounts. And so when a person on the internet is seeking this novelty with so many different images, the brain actually gets overactivated with dopamine, and two things happen. Actually, three things. The first is that the part of the brain, the frontal cortex that thinks about right and wrong and that has judgment and can make good decisions, and I would even argue the part of us that has a conscience, that part gets shut down. And then the part that says, I got to have it, I want to do this, our impulse part, that gets turned up. So it's as if the volume gets turned down on our capacity to think well and to make good choices, and our impulse and our desire gets turned up, and those go head to head, and then we end up choosing something we don't want. And every time a person does that, it creates or carves out a pathway in the brain that makes it easier and easier to happen every time. And that's why it is so addictive. And there have been studies that have shown that pornography online is as addictive and has the same kind of impact on the brain as crack cocaine and even heroin.
Wow. Glenn, what are your thoughts on that?
No, I think that's right, and I think it's intense, and I think that's a cycle that gets more and more intense, just like you were saying, Michael. And then people feel like, I think this all the time. You know, the Apostle Paul in Romans 7 says, I do the very things I hate. The things I want to do, I don't do. The things I hate, I do. And I think, right, he's talking about this thing, like, except this is like an amplified version of that. Like, you get to that point in your brain, it's like you literally start craving and thinking constantly about all the things you don't actually want.
Yeah, and your body tells you that you want it because
right.
it's a physical craving, but
right.
it's not actually what your heart wants. And
right.
that's why it's
exactly.
so important to make a distinction between our true self, the spiritual person that we are in Christ, and that's
right.
in union with God in Christ, and then the part of us that is our physical being. And God is not anti-physical or anti-matter.
Right.
Our bodies are important to him. But to make that distinction helps us to realize the difference between a physical craving and our actual spiritual thirst and hunger.
Right.
So if there is this dopamine release with the click of every time you click the mouse, you get another little high of dopamine, that's going to wear off over time, and you're going to find yourself drifting into other places looking for that next new high. Is that fair?
That's exactly it, yeah. So it sets up a cycle of craving where you need more and more and more. And in Surfing for God, I call that cycle for men the lather, rinse, repeat model. And again, it's an image for right. for women as well. It's an issue, but the lather, rinse, repeat for the older generation is, you know, what they used to write on the shampoo bottle right. instructions, where you go over and over and over again, and there's no hope. And I find, as I've literally traveled around the world talking with men with sexual brokenness that are Christians, they literally believe that this is as good as it gets. This is all there is. You know, right. I'm forgiven, and I have to confess and just be forgiven every time. But there's no way out of this.
Right. So when you consider the context of men, and I'm not going to leave women out of this because I know they're involved in this as well, just not to the degree that men are, but
right.
the consequences, whether they know it or not, that they're bringing into their life can be extremely damaging, can it?
Yeah, absolutely. And what most men don't realize, and even secular social networks and secular men's groups and secular medicine is beginning to talk about not the moral consequences of this and whether it's right or wrong, but the medical and social and relational impact of pornography, how it's dividing marriages, how it's causing trauma to spouses, how it's causing men to isolate and to disengage from relationship, how it's hurting men in their career, how men are losing their jobs. And then one of the most fascinating clinical things that, that physicians are seeing is that pornography is causing erectile dysfunction in men in their teens and their 20s, that men get sensitized to only being able to look at porn and become aroused, and mm-hmm. they can't perform with an actual person.
Wow.
And this is one of the issues that led to the state of Utah declaring pornography a public health crisis, which has now transitioned into the Republican convention next week, where one of their key issues is that pornography is a public health crisis.
And I don't think anyone in this room is disagreeing.
Right.
Including our guest.
Yeah, the renowned sex addiction researcher and considered by many people kind of the patriarch of the sex addiction field, Dr. Patrick Carnes, said that we've not even begun to see the tsunami that's approaching the shore in terms of the level of sexual brokenness that's in our culture. And that's saying a lot considering how bad things are.
Mm-hmm. So when a woman desires to be cherished and to be thought of as the one and only, which in fact she is in a marriage, and this comes into it, at what level does that rattle her foundation?
Oh, it's core to her foundation, because that is the question that a woman is asking,
am I enough?
Chosen
mm-hmm.
and am I cherished? And you know, whether the wife is a supermodel or not, it's not about that, but deep in her core, she right. wants to be wanted not for her looks, but for who she is as a woman and as a person and as a daughter of the living God. And so the question is, what's wrong with me?
Right.
You know, why am I not enough? And that's the wound to her soul. But on the flip side is the calling of a man and a husband, and the blessed opportunity that we have is to impart to our wife, our girlfriend, or the woman in our life that you are wanted, you are desired, you are cherished. And when that doesn't happen, it's not just hurtful, but research is also really building up that it's actually traumatic. And one study, actually there are several studies that report that the betrayal from when a spouse looks at pornography has the same potential set of symptoms and impact as when a woman is sexually assaulted.
Wow. Okay, we need to go to break here, Michael. We'll be back with Michael Cusick and Dr. Glenn Pickering still with me in studio. This is Bill Arnold sitting in for Susie. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Live the Promise. Thanks for joining us today. Again, a heads up, a little warning. We are talking about a very adult conversation today, so we might want to shield the little ears from some of the words you might be hearing, although we are going about this with the utmost caution. We're talking to Michael Cusick, who is the founder and president of RestoringTheSoul.com. He is a licensed professional counselor and pastor and author of a couple of books. And the one that resonates with most of us Men is surfing for gods, discovering the divine desire beneath sexual struggle and somebody's daughter, an experimental guide. That's his other book. I think I kind of butchered that, but I do that from time to time. And in studio with me from my first hour is Dr. Glenn Pickering. I've asked him to stick around and join the conversation. And Glenn, you've got a question.
Yeah, Michael, I thought the thing you said just before break was so powerful about how for women finding out, oh my gosh, you've been doing what, is like literally a trauma. And I'm thinking there are people listening who are thinking, oh my gosh, that's what's been happening to me. And so I wonder, I would love it if you could talk a little bit about how does your ministry help those women? Like, what's the first step? If somebody were listening and think, now that I know that, what can I do? What would you tell them?
Well, the first thing I tell them is to go to our website, restoringthesoul.com, and if you go to the resources section, there's a talk that my wife Julianne gave, and it's a one-hour testimony, for lack of a better term, called Devastated But Not Destroyed, and it's the first time she ever publicly shared her story, and I think it's her best talk that she's ever given. And she talks about what happened in her own heart, but she also talks about the journey that I was on. And by no means is everyone's experience that way, but it's in large part this journey of self-blame.
Right.
And so a woman will blame herself not just with, this is my fault, I somehow wasn't enough for my husband, that his eyes went somewhere else. But then if she starts to feel anxious, not trusting, if she starts to get the jitters, if she starts to have difficulty sleeping, oftentimes Christian women will say, oh, well, I should just be over this. Or, you know, I said I forgave him.
Right.
And so to be aware of the physical symptoms that are going on, it's very, very common for women to develop stomach pains, headaches, skin issues that might seem like physical issues, but it's actually the pain and the emotional turmoil getting kind of turned inward. And the second thing I'd say, so be aware of what's happening in your body. And the second thing is find someone to talk to, just to be able to process this. If it's a pastor, if it's a trusted friend, and ideally a counselor who can look at this from the perspective of, this really is a big deal, and here's how you can, in the best sense of the word, protect your own heart as your husband wrestles with this.
Right.
Finally, I see a fair amount of women who will minimize this.
Right.
Oh, well,
right.
You know, he just did it once, he told me. And chances are it's not just once, but oftentimes there's the sense of, well, thank God it's not a real woman that he's having an affair with.
Right.
But a woman has this intuition that she knows that there's an actual betrayal there. And I think a woman also has a sense inwardly that it's not just that his eyes are doing this, but that his heart is going somewhere. So husbands will often say, or men will say, well, I was just looking. You know, it's not like but it's hard for us to put our eyes somewhere where our heart doesn't follow.
Right.
Michael, I remember when I was in grade school, you know, the big threat was, that's going to go on your permanent record. I'm going, oh, what are you talking about? What do you mean permanent record? You know, that was always the big fear. Well, you had some violation that would be stuck with you for life. And it seems to me in these kind of occasions where there's an exposed person to say, boy, I've been doing this, that's on their permanent record. And that's going to follow them the rest of their life. And is there a period that a spouse can say, I'm starting to develop trust in you again? And how long of a period is that?
Well, I want to respond to that on several levels. I think that trust happens organically. It's not just a matter of time. I've worked with a number of people that have gone to other counselors around the country and in Colorado, where I'm based, where those counselors require lie detector tests. And in my 25 years of being a licensed clinician, I've only twice had people take lie detector tests. But the problem with it is that it communicates, although there's some help of getting a baseline, especially with somebody who is just a pathological liar. What happens is it when the person passes the lie detector test, there's then this sense of, well, now you should be able to trust me. But it has no barometer for what's actually going on inside of the person's heart. And I know women who had their spouses taken lie detector test, and that person has passed the test, and the wife says, well, there's still just something not right, and that's
right.
Because she doesn't have the husband's heart.
Right.
So it's a tricky issue. But the other issue that I want to bring up is that as men, we are so terrified that we're going to be defined by shame, and we're going to defined by our failure. And the message of Jesus and the message of the gospel that is defined all throughout Jesus' teaching and the gospel that's concealed in the Old Testament, but that we especially see in the teaching of Paul and Jesus, is this idea that when we are weak, we are strong.
Right.
And that in our failure and in our brokenness, that's when we are the most powerful for Christ. And therefore, I tell men, don't work too hard to try to get over that sense of what your permanent record is. Because before God, when Paul is speaking about how we have no righteousness of our own, I think everybody would say, yeah, that's good theology. But then on a practical level, we somehow
right.
want to gain righteousness.
Right. Do we live that out, right?
Yeah, so trust is ultimately gained certainly by change in behavior, but more so even by a change in the heart.
Right.
A lot of the men I work with freak out that they'll call me up and they'll say, you know, I had a slip and my wife's going to kill me. What should I do? And I say, well, tell her so that she can understand your heart, that this is not who you are and who you want to be. Well, if I tell her, it'll hurt her and I'll be in the doghouse and, you know, I'll feel great shame. Well, Jesus can cover that, and he's enough, because it's actually an opportunity to build intimacy and to create connection over the shared vulnerability, the vulnerability of the husband coming and saying, here's where I've failed and where I'm broken and where I've sinned, and the vulnerability of the wife of, here's where I'm really hurt and it's hard to trust you. And intimacy almost always happens where there's mutual vulnerability.
Right. We're talking about what I call the 50-50 rule, Michael, just before this, and that's a perfect example. So if the guy comes before his wife and says, hey, I want to just be totally transparent, I want to confess this, he then also needs his wife to be open instead of sort of shaming and judging, like, I knew you were terrible. It's like, no, to actually be saying, hey, this is hard to hear, but I'm still glad you told me. I still want to be in that process with you. I still want to make this different, because unless we're both doing our part differently, we're just going to get stuck in that old pattern like you were saying.
Yes, yeah.
It's interesting, because when you are scared about relapsing and you're scared to go and put yourself in a position where you could be absolutely thrown back into the dark ages because you're trying to make progress, and this will set you back so far that your tendency would be to not want to confess it, right? But when
right.
you do, you actually are then building on the trust level that you ultimately want to get to, which is ultimately going to be where you're going to have the most amount of freedom and probably the better relationship.
Yeah, so we work with men and tell them that, of course, sin has consequences, but in the process of recovery, the issue is less about did you sin and more about are you living in hiddenness. And
right. What's
so,
the secret?
You know, the problem in Genesis chapter 3 is not what Adam and Eve did. It's the fact that they tried to hide it.
Right.
They covered up their shame with fig leaves, and then when God shows up saying, where are you, they run off into the trees. And what that did was it reinforced the belief and the lie of the evil one, who said, you won't surely die. You can't trust God. He's not really telling you the truth. And so it's all based on a deception. So when a man or woman lives with that deep fear of, oh, I'm going to be found out, and that's going to be awful, it's based on the deception that trusting and intimacy are really dangerous things as opposed to life-giving things.
Right.
That's really an interesting point.
Right. And it's also about not only do you trust that other person, but just like you were saying so powerfully, you actually trust God. You trust the promise.
Exactly.
Jesus said, yeah.
That, yeah. So that,
go ahead.
Because I'm sure there's people listening saying, well, I that sounds great, Michael, you know, that will develop intimacy. But I share and I confess and I get yelled at or beat up or my partner
right.
goes silent. And that's when it's not a platitude, but we say, like Paul in 2 Corinthians 12, when he cried out with the thorn in the flesh, God said, Paul, my grace is sufficient. I'm
right.
enough. And so that at some level we can't escape in this journey of recovery coming to this place where we cry out, God, you've got to be enough for me.
Right. So can I sort of segue a little bit from that one?
Go ahead.
Sure.
Yeah,
okay,
absolutely.
Sure. So I see a lot of clients who, when there's been a sexual disruption of some sort, an affair, who knows what, maybe pornography, and so there's a disruption in the couple's sexual life, obviously, for a time. And then, so when it's time to feel like, okay, we want to start reconstructing that part of our relationship, what kind of guidance do you give people when they're just trying to figure out how to put that back together?
Oh, that's such an important question because...
I wrote that one too. I'm sick of handing him notes.
These are the kinds of things that people don't talk about. So just a shout out to the radio station and for you, Bill, for going here today because people are desperate to hear this. The first thing is that physical intimacy consists of so much more than intercourse or even full-on sexual intimacy. So one of the things I talk with couples a lot about in this process of recovery, whether it's porn or an affair or other kinds of sexual sin, is developing more and more in the relationship of non-sexual physical touch.
Right.
And what this does is it builds safety, but it also creates bonding. When couples hold each other in non-sexual ways, and it can be sitting on a couch where their legs are touching each other, holding hands, or it can be standing, hugging, or side by side in bed. Talk about chemicals being released with porn. When you hold each other in non-sexual ways and cuddle, the chemical oxytocin is released into the system, and that's known as the cuddle hormone. And so that's a way to create bonding and safety. And more often than not over the years, and Glenn, I'm just absolutely sure you probably hear this in your practice, that women will say, every time I ask for a hug and we hug for more than 5 seconds, you know, it turns into a request for sex.
Right.
And so I think men can learn to offer non-sexual physical touch in ways where it's not going to lead there.
Right.
That can build a sense of safety and build mutual trust as well.
Right.
That's probably something that men need to work on all the time, is the whole idea that there's touching and affection that isn't necessarily going anywhere other than touching and affection.
Right. And
exactly.
I think the weird thing is, I was lucky enough when my daughter was younger to spend one day a week at a school with her for years. And what I saw is that with boys, if they're happy to see each other, they high-five each other. If they're playing games, they bang into each other. If they're mad, they push and shove each other. And I realized guys don't have any emotion that doesn't have a physical component to it. So my wife can say 10,000 times, Glenn, I love you. And I think, oh, okay. That means it gets in a little bit. Or she can touch me gently on the shoulder and say, Glenn, I really love you. And then it's like, oh, wow, that was powerful.
That worked, huh?
And so I think so often women think, well, I just want touching, but guys only want sex. And I think, no, you don't get it. We need touch worse than you do. It's just that for some reason in our culture, when boys are like 8 or 9 or 10, we quit touching them. So they're touch deprived. So when there's finally they get older and there's a girl in their life who's physically touching them in some romantic way, they think, oh, my goodness, I need this.
Mm.
And they start thinking it's all about sex, and they probably pressure their partners about that. And their partner might think it's only about sex, but honest to goodness, we need to be touched more often than they do.
Mm, interesting.
But we get that messed up, I think, a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Glenn, that is so powerful. There's actually growing research right now that talks about touch deprivation for men and women. But I just want to say that again, what you said, that I agree wholeheartedly with you that men need touch more than women do because it's less socially acceptable for us to ask for it.
Right.
And in my sexual addiction, and I see this with so many men, Thomas Aquinas, the philosopher from the 15th century, said that every sinful behavior is rooted in a legitimate God-given appetite.
See, that's what I think. There's something you want. You're just not going about it right.
Exactly. So oftentimes the struggle with porn is that I'm craving and longing for physical touch. Now, that doesn't mean sex. It means just literally touch.
Right.
And I've spoken about this a number of times, and it always feels a little awkward to say it, but I also always get feedback from people going, oh, my gosh, that was so helpful. But when I was at the worst of my sexual addiction, I was a Christian man, and I loved God, and I did not want to be doing what I was doing. And I escalated in my addiction to paying for sex commercially for prostitutes. And as I was doing that, internally I was saying, I don't want to be doing this. I just want to be held. The longing was for that comfort.
Right. I see the same thing with guys who have affairs. Right.
Yeah. In my story, I can go back and see how that was tied into the fact that shortly after I was born, my mom was hospitalized, and I was the youngest of five, and my sisters raised me. And so there was a lot of wounding there that set me up for that. But oftentimes, in men's groups. It's funny how when we do men's groups for recovery, how guys, you know, they won't leave without giving each other a big bear hug.
Right, because that's part of the experience. And so I love what you're talking about going, you know, if we're going to start working on coming back together sexually, we'll start with sort of that, what I call small sex, that touch, gentle cuddling. Mm-hmm. And it's important for the guys to hear, yeah, the woman needs that to see that you're safe. But it's important for the guys to hear, and so do you.
Yeah. Okay, we are going to have one more segment with Michael Cusick. If you have a question, give us a call, 1-877-933-2484. You're listening to Live the Promise. Bill Arnold in for Susie Larson. We'll be right back. Thanks for being with us today. Bill Arnold in for Susie. We're talking to Michael Cusick. He's written a book called Surfing for God, talking about the problem with pornography. So, again, a quick reminder to be careful with the young ears that might be in the room. And Michael, it seems that the difference between today's problem with porn and 30 years ago is 30 years ago you were trying a cigarette for the first time. And in today's porn, you're getting crack cocaine for the first time, just because porn all over the broadband internet is a very different experience. So these younger kids are getting exposed to it at a younger age and at a much higher level of porn.
Yes, and it's everywhere. So when people ask me the statistics about how bad it is, the statistics are changing so often. I just say that the pornography is like secondhand smoke. And, of course, with secondhand smoke, you may be a smoker. But even if you're not a smoker, the secondhand smoke can still kill you or deeply impact you. And it's everywhere. And even if a person's not actively looking at porn, it's sending messages about sexuality. And porn has been integrated into pop culture, situation comedies, it's, you know, it's everywhere, and it's just widely accepted. So the other difference is that 30 years ago, a person might be embarrassed or ashamed and not want anyone to know. And today, for men, it's kind of a badge that they wear.
Mm, wow, that's horrible. How do we have these conversations with kids?
Oh, I'm so glad you brought that up, because there's a book out Anne Marie Miller, who is an author out of Iowa. She's written a book called 5 Things Every Parent Needs to Know About Their Kids and Sex. And I've read a number of books, and a parent of 2 teenagers, I'm familiar with them, but this is, I think, the best book out there. Anne Marie Miller, 5 Things Every Parent Needs to Know About Their Kids and Sex. And the biggest thing I'd say is that my generation, you know, the idea was that the kid hit puberty, and at some point a parent had a talk with them about the birds and the bees, and even there they were using euphemisms, right?
Mm-hmm.
You sit down, you have a talk, and in the best case scenario in a Christian family, you might do a weekend or a book or something like that. But that talk and the sex talk needs to be a lifelong series of talks, beginning at a very, very early age with conversation about the body and appropriate touch and pictures that are good to see and not good to see. And the biggest thing is for parents to do their own work about their own sexuality, including places where they feel shame and might, for reasons they don't fully understand, not want to engage around this conversation.
I heard talking about skin hunger, that when young kids start to get a little bit older and they get a little bit more awkward, they start getting less touch, less appropriate touch from, you know, parents and uncles and aunts and that kind of thing. And yet they have this incredible skin hunger and desire to be touched. And that alone can take them into territory where they find themselves getting sexually active way, way, way earlier than they should, which is never.
It's a mean catch 22 there. So when they need it the most, the parents tend to withdraw.
Right.
And I make it a point with both of my kids to scratch their back and to rub my fingers through their hair. And
mm-hmm.
even my son, who's 18, he's embarrassed, but I kiss him goodnight every night.
Mm-hmm.
And that affection is something that's desperately needed.
Right, and I think it's like everything else. I know you know this, Michael. If we don't get the stuff in the right place, then we look for it in the wrong place. Like if I'm not getting good, healthy food, so I walk around hungry, even the junk food starts looking good.
Exactly.
Well, Michael, what about if you have suspicion or thoughts that there's something going on in your marriage. And how do you get that conversation started?
Well, I think forthrightness and not walking on eggshells or beating around the bush is important.
Right.
I always recommend with couples that they have full access to one another's smartphones and devices and computers, and that spouses, you know, unless they're working for the CIA or something, shouldn't have special passwords where the other person can't look in. And that doesn't mean that the other person should be snooping, but there's access, and that if need be, there's something communicated that nothing's being hidden. I think also I like to have the conversation not are you looking at porn, but when have you looked at porn?
Right.
How much porn are you looking at? Because even men that don't, quote, struggle with it, where they're compelled to look again and again, we're exposed to it in all kinds of different ways. And I think that just being really, really forthright about it. And instead of asking black and white questions like,
right,
do you struggle with porn, which a man is going to fill in the blank of what he means by struggle and what his wife means by struggle, is what's it like for you to live in a pornified world?
Nice.
What's it like to be a man and to live in a world where it's encouraged for you to objectify women? What's it like for you to be a man and to know that this is the world that I live in and that this is wounding toward me?
I love that, because it's like I can be watching an NFL game and minding my own business, and I'm going to suddenly be showing shots of cheerleaders wearing next to nothing, doing things that shouldn't be seen in public, and everybody acts like that's okay. Like, what? Like, so you're right. It's, even if you don't feel like, well, I struggle with pornography, we're still affected by it in all kinds of ways. So how are you affected by it? That's a great question.
Yeah. And then after the cheerleaders, a Carl's Jr. commercial comes on, and they're using body parts to sell hamburgers, and they've used Hugh Hefner as their spokesperson before. So the message there is that this hip old guy who has all the women he wants, that's what a real man is.
Right.
And those are conversations that fathers and sons can have as well, or mothers and sons.
Right.
But talking about not just the images that are being looked at, but what do you believe about sexuality?
Mm-hmm. Michael, I know that there's a lot of broken hearts out there as a result of this problem, and there's a lot of people still struggling, and there's people in their car driving home thinking, uh-oh, I've been reminded that I've got a problem. And there's certainly lots of marriages. I know several myself that have split over this issue, and I wondered if you would say a word of prayer for the folks that are driving home and listening at home and struggling with this issue.
Absolutely. I'm honored. Lord Jesus and Heavenly Father and Holy Spirit, when you came, Jesus, you said that you came to bind up broken hearts and set captives free. And we thank you that we're not defined by the darkness in our life and that we are not held captive to sin. Thank you that you've made a way for us to be free. So I pray for the men that are struggling, that you would give them courage and humility to come into the light. And I pray for women that are struggling and especially stigmatized, that you would give them courage and boldness to trust in you and to trust one other person. I pray for partners and spouses that are experiencing betrayal and confusion and pain, that you'd give them hope, that you would restore them, that you'd restore marriages. And God, as this upcoming election is coming, this is not a partisan issue, God. It's a bipartisan issue. It's something that is ultimately about your kingdom. So would you use all the discussion around what is good and right and decent, would you use that to bring your kingdom so that your will be done on earth as it is in heaven, and start in our hearts and our lives. In Jesus' name, amen.
Michael Cusack, you're such a gift. Thank you so much for writing Surfing for God and your website, restoringthesoul.com. And I do want to recommend that highly. And I want to say, if you are a woman wanting to hear his wife's side of the story, Julianne Cusack's testimony, which lasts about an hour, is worth every minute of your time. And I know she had written her whole message getting ready to preach it, and then didn't sleep the night before and scrapped it and spoke right from her heart.
Mm-hmm.
It is one powerful hour. And thank you so much for the difference you're making in the lives of families and men who struggle with this. And again, thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Bless you, Bill. Take care.
Thanks so much. Well, that wraps up today. If you want to pass this on, please go to our website, myfaithradio.com, and you can hear this message and send it on to a friend. Thanks so much for listening. I'll be here next week, a little bit, for Susie, but she'll be back. That's the good news.